Okay, bunch of things. I guess people do read email as far as the homework extensions are concerned. They don't read emails regarding the blog discussions and all that stuff. So I know what to put as a heading for blog discussions. It's like one of these publishers clearinghouse sweepstakes. You may already have one in extension. So the homework is due on Wednesday. And then a couple of other things. I'm working on giving you the project 2, which will I'm hoping to give it out by next class, and it'll be due in about 15 to 20 days. Okay, so you can figure out how long it, I mean, just so that you know. And the project is going to be on using CSP techniques to solve Sudoku. Okay, and then, so I'll give you, as usual, I'll give you much of the code. Essentially what I'm planning to do is give you code which does normal backtracking on Sudoku. Okay, so I represent the problem, I represent most of the constraints, and I give you a simple backtracking algorithm. It's a CSP backtracking algorithm. And then all I'm going to ask you to do is add some of the heuristics. So most constrained variable, which is a couple of lines, most constraining value, another couple of lines, forward checking, a few more lines. Okay. So of course you need to understand the code, and then it's only 1.5 pages, I think, long. Again, it's going to be in Lisp. And then it's also actually quite nice to see that, for example, one of the harder versions, I think test case 4 or something, I was checking yesterday, with just backtracking, it takes something like 3 million assignments, you know, to solve it. And with backtracking and most constrained variable ordering, it takes about 30,000 assignments. And with backtracking and most constrained variable and forward checking, it takes about 220 assignments. So that's improvement, right? It turns out that Sudoku, unfortunately, is one of, you know, it has some advantages and some disadvantages as a CSP problem. It's a widely known problem that you already know of, and it's kind of cute to say that I can solve Sudoku using CSP. But on the other hand, you cannot arbitrarily increase the size of the problem. I cannot keep increasing the number of, the normal thing is 9x9 board, and that's the one that you wind up, is it 9x9? Right, yeah. I'm not a Sudoku player. As I told you, I was made to solve this by my son's teacher, and so I thought I will write a CSP program that, you know, next year at least I'll be well prepared. Okay, so that's what is going to be the project too, and it's going to be, you know, direct application of CSP techniques. Okay. Midterm is likely to be around the middle of the month of October. I think 10-17 looks like a good time. Okay, but I would tell you again, you know, I'll confirm the date, but you know approximately that's the date exactly. And normally I have the midterm in class, so it would be, one class would be last. I don't like it, but I think that would be a in-class exam. Okay, yes, sir.
Do you have any information on the midterm as far as like what percentage of our grade is it?
Normally it's about 20% of your grade, but I'll let you know again all those details. And they're long, and nobody expects to be done and check their answers during the exam. So just realize, I mean, when you get the midterm exam, and I'll show you some of the specimen midterms from the last time. I think you may have seen some of the questions anyway in the homeworks, but I'll give you like an entire midterm. I set long exams, okay? But there are ways in which I delude myself that that's a reasonable thing to do, and I'll give you those reasonings too, but the fact of the matter is they'll be long. They'll test you on pretty much everything, and so if you just know some things and not other things, you know, you pay for it, okay? So whereas you can't luck out by just knowing a couple of things. That's the advantage. But on the other hand, if you are one of those people who just look at the heft of the exam and just lose heart or have a heart attack actually is good because the entire class would stop having an exam. But lose heart is bad because you would actually you won't do well. Okay, so just realize that it's hard for everybody. It's not, it's going to check how much, not only how much you know, but how fast can you answer it. So both of them, at least for in class. Okay, that's the way it is. I'm not making any, I do take homes too. Normally in the past I have done take homes for the final. I might do it again this year, but I think you need both. I need both to test you guys as to whether things are actually making it or not. Okay, yes sir.
Be our goal for studying for the exam?
Study everything. I'll give you my exam things and you look at them, but I have no surveys, I have no revision, I don't have any reviews. We will probably have review sessions beforehand, but if I run the review session, I show up and I ask you guys, what do you want me to talk about? So there are no, this is my feeling is, there is an advantage. There is one thing about in-class exam, which is it forces you to read and understand as much of the material as you can. Okay? And take-homes don't have that, because once you see the exam, you'll only read the stuff in the, in the take-home. So I wind up doing both. I do know that people who are exam anxious don't do well in exams, but on the other hand, I'm assuming that you guys In the spectrum of exam anxiousness, you must have been not at the highest anxiousness end, because you wouldn't have survived up until now, because we would have weeded you out for better or worse in grade school itself. Yes, sir.
Is there like a good set of problems that we could just extract from some kind of resource or just kind of
all the homework problems? Homework problems, for example, and then I'll give you a specimen exam too.
Okay.
And beyond that, you can look up, for example, it all depends on how much interest you have. You can look at other people's CSE 471 homepages from various universities and see what are they asking, if you want, and I can't stop you from doing that. It's, that will only help you understand more things, so that's the thing.
Is it open note or?
Normally, it's open book. Yes. But on the other hand, if you are depending on opening the book to figure out, you normally won't do too well in the in-class exam. Okay, so it is open book.
But no notes.
Open everything, except internet, I think. Internet, the class notes are fine. So in fact, I'll allow you guys to bring in your laptops and look at the class notes, but I will be here, so if you are having a nice chat with your friend, then I'll bring the friend in and have them as a student. It will be good to have them instead of you. Anyway, that's all about the exam. Any other questions? Yes, sir. What?
There's an email question about the reading list.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, in fact, I should change it. The reading list is not, I'm assuming that you guys listen to me and then figure out what the reading list is, but I should be more proactive. Part of it was, as I think Gavin pointed out, that the reading list, I haven't changed the chapter correspondences. They are more like, more in tune with the order in which I did things last time, but I'm doing it in a different order this time. But again, CSP, where the CSP material is. Propositional logic, where the propositional logic material is. There's a chapter pretty much on that. Okay. I can make sure that the chapters, if you have come to the classes, I'll never ask anything that I did not discuss in the class. I'm discussing enough that I don't have to depend on, asking you stuff that is in the textbook but I didn't discuss in the class. If I didn't discuss it, you're not responsible. You can learn it, it's good for you, but it's not. I'm not going to. Yes, we will get to it later. We're not doing it now. Yeah, I changed the order, and I don't know which order works well, but every time I have to do something different just to stay awake. So this time I'm changing it such that, because we wound up last year's time, they didn't get to do CSP, for example. So you're doing CSP this time. And having done CSP, it turns out it's a much more interesting segue into propositional logic, because CSP to SAT, SAT to propositional logic is just a great segue. And then having done that, I am going to the next topic I'll be doing it is probabilistic propositional logic, which is Bayesian and networks and all that stuff, which is great stuff. Normally we wind up doing it in the end of the semester, but now we're doing it earlier. And it's actually very useful stuff. It's relevant for all sorts of other applications. So you'll wind up doing that after this. In fact, next class we'll probably be doing probabilistic propositional logic. Okay? Other question? So actually I have more students today for some weird reason. I mean, I haven't seen these many students in the class. So I guess people aren't actually attending the classes. because I see, you know, many more people anyway, and fresh faces too. That means probably they had good sleep. Anyway, if there are no other questions, what I'm going to do in today's class is mostly a faster paced review of what was done last class with slides. Okay, last class we actually pretty much discussed everything important about propositional logic, entailment, etc. There are some aspects that I didn't get through last time, plus I didn't actually go through in the order of the slides, so I'm going to do that today. Okay, and depending on how soon we get through that, we will start talking about probabilistic propositional logic, which is Bayes network and all that fun stuff. Okay, one thing that I did not go through is this slide last time. So if you are coming into knowledge representation directly, one thing that you would be talking about is exactly what should be the knowledge representation language representing. Okay, remember last time we got into the propositional logic directly more or less from SAT. Okay, but the question is, if you are trying to talk about a logic to represent the world, what are the kinds of things that you need to care about? And here is an interesting way of looking at the languages, in characterizing the languages. So for each language, you can talk about two commitments that language makes. One is ontological commitment, which means what does the language think is there in the world to talk about? Okay. For example, propositional logic thinks that the world is made up of statements which are either true or false. That's what it thinks. Okay. So that's why, in fact, each proposition is a true-false variable, and then every statement in propositional logic ultimately, of course, is an assertion that's either true or false. And the statements are made up from propositions. Okay. In particular, what the propositional logic does not admit is that there are objects in the world. Okay. If you have objects in the world, you can convert the objects in the world into assertion. So for example, you know, I would like to believe that there is an object called Rav in the world who has lots of properties, lots of relations with other objects and so on. If I were to represent my knowledge about Rav in propositional logic, it would have to become a huge number of disconnected propositions. So for example, Rav slash is slash happy will become one proposition. Rav slash has as a friend slash Jim. Okay, that would become another proposition. Okay, what I would like to do, given that you know object-oriented languages, is to kind of say that Rav is an object who has properties, unary properties, as well as binary properties, as well as multi-array properties, you know, which were relations between multiple objects. Okay, if you want if you want to admit that the world actually has more than facts, then you have to go to first-order logic, which will come after propositional logic. Okay, the first order logic essentially admits that there are facts in the world, of course, but there are also objects and there are also relations between objects. So it's a question of what you admit the world has. So you can write programs in C++ or C or assembly language. The difference between C++ and assembly language is C++ essentially admits upfront, allows you to admit upfront that there are objects. Okay. Everything ultimately in C++ is compiled down to assembly language, okay? Which actually brings up the issue, if you were to, so between first order and propositional logic, the way I just mentioned this, it looks as if everything written in first order logic can ultimately be compiled down to propositional logic, okay? In particular, there's this beautiful word or phrase called syntactic sugar. Syntactic sugar essentially means The language just allows you a bunch of macros to sort of act as if the world has objects and relations and so on. But then at the end of the day, you can compile it down to propositional logic. And so really, if you understand propositional logic, you understand this other logic too. Okay, it's sort of true in assembly language versus C++ to some extent, right? But on the other hand, in fact, we'll find out when we get to first order logic that this is not actually true for the relation between first order and propositional logic. Under fairly benign conditions, first order logic compilation to propositional logic would be infinitely large. Okay, you know that when you compile a higher level language program into a lower level language, the size increases. What you don't like is the size to increase without bound. Okay, it should not, it would be best if the size is actually linearly connected. You can live with it if it is polynomially connected to the original program. You can also probably live with it even if it is exponentially connected. But if it is unbounded, that means, the size of the program, assembly program for this higher level language is infinitely large, then that's no good. That's not a compilation. In fact, in that case, it's a strictly more expressive language. You can say things compactly, really compactly, finitely, that you couldn't say in the other language. Okay, so we will look at, when we look at first order logic, when we'll get to it, we will realize that, in fact, when for most conditions, first order logic can actually be compiled down with probably a polynomial increase, in fact, an exponential increase in the size of the knowledge base. But there are, as soon as you throw in functions, it winds up being infinitely large. That means you cannot actually compile it down to a finite size proposition. So there is expressivity as you start admitting that there are more objects. There are objects and relations between objects. Now, in terms of ontological commitment, suppose even in first order logic, one of the things we'll find is that first order logic does not, for example, admit that time is a special kind of thing.
Will you go into examples of each of these?
We will get to it later on. Okay. So for example, time is, in first order logic, we don't consider time to be anything special. For example, in propositional logic, we don't consider relations and objects to be anything special. So if you actually have Rav is a friend of Jim, you would have probably written something like that in first order logic. But in propositional logic, you would say Rao is a friend of Jim. That's just a single proposition symbol. So it does not admit that there is anything special about objects versus relations. And if you go from first order logic to temporal first order logic, you admit that not only are there objects, relations, etc., there is a special kind of object called time. And in fact, you include assumptions about how time goes. For example, time goes forward. You compile that into the language. Okay? It's like having library support, if you think of from the programming language point of view. So temporal logic already assumes that there are facts, objects, relations, and times. So it admits even more things are there. Okay? Now, when we come to, for example, probabilistic propositional logic that we will be talking about in like next class, it turns out that the probabilistic propositional logic versus propositional logic don't differ much in terms of what they think the world is made up of. They both think the world is made up of facts. Okay? So it turns out that in this dimension, probabilistic propositional logic and propositional logic are the same. And similarly, you could have a probabilistic first-order logic, which would be the same as first-order logic in terms of ontological commitment. So that means it actually admits that there are facts, objects, and relations. Okay? Now, there is a different dimension that's equally important, which is epistemological commitment. In particular, what is the truth value of a statement that you can make? What are the possible truth values of a statement that you can make in this language? What's interesting on that side is propositional logic, first order logic, temporal logic, all of them ultimately say that every sentence that you can write in this language is either true or false. Okay? So it's only two possible values. Okay? Of course, it can be unknown. We'll talk about that in today's entailment issue, which is, in fact, when I know something about my world, and I ask, is this new fact true? If you can prove the entailment, then it is true. But if you can't prove the entailment, it does not mean it's not true. It only means that there exists at least one model of your knowledge base where this fact is not holding. It doesn't mean that in every model of the knowledge base, the fact negation is true, which is what you need to prove that it's not true. So really, it is true, false, and unknown. Yes, sir? What? Oh, the Gödel's incompleteness theorem. No, don't even talk about it now. It's a bigger thing. But we won't talk about it. It comes more after first order logic. Okay. But in terms of the epistemological commitment, even the logics where Gödel's incompleteness theorem holds, all of them essentially can be making true, false, unknown as the epistemological commitment. Okay. Now, in terms of probability theory, the situation is different. If you have probabilistic propositional logic, a statement, so we actually say, for example, essentially, that if I have a KB and I'm asking, is the fact F entailed? In propositional logic, I can say yes, no, don't know. In probabilistic logic, I'll never say don't know. I'll never say don't know, and in fact, when it is yes, I will be 1.0 is the probability that it is true. When it is no, the probability is 0.0. And the unknown is now split into a continuum of numbers, each corresponding to a different likelihood that this statement is true. Yes, sir? No, the issue of functions, this is an interesting point. The issue of functions and objects, etc., comes in the ontological commitment. And the issue of truth status of a statement written in that language comes in the epistemological commitment. These are orthogonal. You can combine both. You can have first-order probabilistic languages, which there is a huge lack of right now. We don't actually have a good, efficient first-order probabilistic language. That's where most of the research in knowledge representation is going on right now. Okay, there are relational versions of probabilistic languages which admit, for example, objects and relations, but don't allow functions. To allow full first orderness, you need functions too. Okay, so that's the kind of interesting thing. So, if you look at this two-dimensional spectrum, epistemological commitment here and ontological commitment there. Propositional logic falls here, probabilistic propositional logic falls here, first order propositional logic falls here, first order predicate calculus or first order logic falls there, and then probabilistic first order predicate calculus, which doesn't exist. I mean, there are research proposals on it, but there's nothing really out there that I can teach you in this intro to AI class, that would be falling there. And then, in fact, you can start talking about spectrums here too. You know, but that's where the overall spectrum of logics is. And again, another way of looking at it is you can start from propositional logic. If you throw in objects and relations and functions, you will start talking about first order logic. Okay? If from propositional logic you throw in degrees of belief, you start talking about probabilistic propositional logic. Okay? If you throw both of them, so for example, from here, if you throw degree of belief, you will get to first order propositional logic. And from here, if you throw objects and relations, you also get to first order propositional logic. So when you are in propositional logic, after I'm done with propositional logic, I'm faced with this choice of what to teach you next. Should I tell you how to add objects and relations and talk about first order logic? Or should I tell you how to add degrees of belief and teach you first order in probabilistic propositional logic? I have decided to do this first and then this next. But really, I could have extended it in any which way in the class. What I do know for sure is this stuff is not 471 material yet, okay, because it's too close to the frontier of research. Okay. Now, having said all this, out here is fuzzy logic. I'm sorry. Out here is fuzzy logic. And I'm kind of fuzzy about it because I didn't talk about it. What's interesting about fuzzy logic from the point of view of these dimensions is the following. Fuzzy logic assumes that the ontological commitment itself, it assumes that things in the world have degrees of truth. And the epistemological commitment, of course, is degree of belief, but the more important thing is, with respect to propositional logic, this is the biggest difference. Fuzzy logic assumes that the world is made up of things that have different degrees of truth. Okay? The very best example I can give you to differentiate in your own mind between probabilistic propositional logic and fuzzy logic, which a lot of people get into trouble with, is the following example. So, consider a big bucket of puppies. Okay. I mean, you have to remember crazy examples. That's the only way you'll remember forever. Okay. White puppies and red puppies. Okay. 15 of these, 30 of these. Okay. All of them equal size puppies. Okay. And you put your hand in, pick a puppy. You close your eyes. Hope that the puppy hasn't bitten you yet. Okay, and you haven't opened your eyes yet. Okay, can I ask the question, what's the probability that the thing that I'm holding is a white puppy? 15 by 45. What is it that it's a red puppy? 30 by 45. That's the degree of truth before I opened my eyes. Once I opened my eyes, I know exactly the state in which I am in. What's the probability that once I open my eyes, the puppy that I'm holding is neither white nor red, but sort of a color in between? It's a reddish hue. There is no. Either it's fully red or it's fully white. No in between. Okay? Probabilistic logic is that. Probabilistic logic says, in each world, a statement is either true or false. The degree of belief comes because of the 10,000 worlds, in 5,000 of them, it's definitely true. The rest, it's definitely false. So it's one half is the degree of belief on this statement. But in any given world, it's either true or false, no in between. So how do I get fuzzy logic now? Keep them growing, and they start mating in this big bucket, unfortunately. And they have differing colors too now. Okay. So happy, some puppies might be, there are more number of puppies now, puppies don't breed like rabbits, but let's assume another 10 new puppies have come up of differing colors, okay? I'm not a big puppy breeder. It's somewhere between white and red. Each puppy is now going to be somewhere between white and red, right? Beautiful rainbow of color, like us here. Okay? So now the question is, if I now close my eyes and pick a puppy, I can talk again about the probability that it's white, or 50% red, 50% white, or 40% red, 60% white, and so on and so forth. More importantly, now if I open my eyes, it's still not the case that it's just either white or red. It could actually be in between. The specific puppy I picked is 40% white and 60% red. So it's sort of pinkish hue. Okay? That's the best way to remember fuzzy logic. Fuzzy logic, once you, even in the world that you have, essentially the truth value in that world is actually a degree. No. All I'm saying is, when I open my eyes, the puppy in front of me may not be either white or red, but it is in between.
But the question to be asked is the puppy greater than 50%?
That if
red?
You ask that question, again, I am here trying to explain to you the difference between fuzzy logic and probabilistic logic. I'm interested in the difference. Okay, here's the interesting thing. If Martian were to come into this room, right, they'll think, my God, what a design flaw. Everybody looks the same. But when we talk about each other, we say, my God, this guy has short hair, this guy has long hair, this guy has big ears, this guy has, you know, short ears and all that stuff. Okay. I'm talking about the differences between fuzzy logic and probabilistic logic. They actually can be used for applications, the similar applications, depending on the questions you ask. But the important difference, if you were to understand the difference, is that fuzzy logic's ontological commitment is that the world is made up of things which have varying degrees of truth, which is distinct from all the other lines logic. For example, propositional logic, which just assumes the world is made up of facts. Yes, sir?
It seems like there's a lot of ways to say it's both. Is there a whole class of fuzzy logic?
No. So one of the other things, you know, this would get into more detailed discussion, and I might come back to it. One of the interesting things is, so in terms of the technical difference from, you know, starting from here, is a language truth functional? Is a language truth functional? A language is considered truth functional if the truth value of a statement in this language depends only on the truth values of its constituents. Do you understand what I'm saying? A language is truth functional if the truth value of a statement only depends on its constituents. Is propositional logic truth functional? Yes, of course, because the truth value of A, R, B, and C only depends on the truth values of A, B, and C, nothing else. That's why you can write truth tables. The thing we'll find is that this is not true for probabilistic propositional logic. The truth value of a statement depends on the overall world and the other variables for which you're marginalizing, for those of you who remember the probability theory, but we'll get back to it. Okay? So probabilistic logic is not truth functional. Okay, if a language is truth functional, it's easier to handle because you can evaluate the truth value of a statement just in terms of its constituents. Fuzzy logic is truth functional, is designed to be truth functional. So the degree of truth of, for example, what is the degree of truth? Suppose I have A and B. The degree of truth of A and B is what? The minimum of the degrees of truth of A and degree of truth of B. So it's basically defined as minimum of dt of A and dt of B. Okay? So if this was 0.6, this is 0.3, then this will be 0.3. The nice thing is this rule looks like a good rule, right? Because it actually generalizes, it's a general case of the propositional logic, where in propositional logic, these could be either 1 or 0. The minimum of 1 or 0 would always be 0, which is exactly how you define AND. And similarly, you would define degree of truth of A or B as the max of degree of truth of A and degree of truth of B. And then finally, you would define degree of truth of not A as 1 minus degree of truth of A. This is how fuzzy logic is defined. Looks beautiful, but there is an obvious problem with this. So this, by doing this, it becomes truth functional. It becomes just like propositional logic that we all know and love and are happy about. But the problem is, consider this, A or not A. Okay, consider a statement like A or not A. Now, using this rule, it would say it's the max of dt of A and dt of not A. And using this rule, it will say it's 1, so basically, it winds up giving different answers. So in the other case, the not A has to be connected to the degree of truth of A. Okay. Essentially, the plausible reasoning that fuzzy logic tries to encompass cannot actually be made truth functional, but it tries to make it truth functional, and so you wind up having at least some semantic issues. Now, of course, this doesn't mean that the fuzzy logic as an enterprise fell apart. What it does mean is there is a difference, at least as far as this class is concerned, there's a difference between what fuzzy logic thinks the world is made up of and what propositional probabilistic logic thinks the world is made up of. Okay? Yes, sir? So, lots of places. Okay? Basically, one of the interesting things is people realized that propositional logic, pure propositional logic, is not useful enough to represent the real world because the real world does have uncertainty. So, towards the end of this class, we will talk about, for example, several things that propositional logic can't handle. You know, you already know that it can't handle things like facts and objects and relations, but that winds up being less important than the fact that it doesn't handle uncertainty. Okay, now why is uncertainty important? In fact, I'll go ahead and say that now, there's one later. Uncertainty is important in many cases. All the propositional logic that you know and love is monotonic. I'm answering your question, but in a long-winded way. Okay? Propositional logic is monotonic. What does monotonicity mean? Monotonicity means that if you have KB1 and you took the time to prove fact F is true, now if you have KB1 plus F dash, you don't have to check to see if F is true. It will still be true. As extra knowledge is gained, the proofs that you made in the past will still be proofs. This is a property of monotonic logic. This is a definite property of propositional logic. Unfortunately, real world doesn't work that way. There are many cases where as the evidence mounts, you keep changing your mind. You know, the classic case is Tweety the bird. Okay? So I say Tweety is a bird. What do you think about its flying? Flies or not flies? Flies. Tweety is an ostrich. I just added an extra piece of information. Does it fly or not fly? And those of you who never went to a zoo, I'll tell you that ostriches don't fly. So Tweety doesn't fly. Now I add an extra piece of information. Tweety is a magical ostrich. It flies. Tweety is a magical ostrich that just got cursed by an evil witch. Doesn't fly. Tweety is a magical ostrich which got cursed by an evil witch but somehow did some, you know, prayer to the god and got out of its curse, flying again. Make up your mind, for crying out loud, right? You're saying fly, not fly, fly, not fly, fly, not fly. You keep changing your mind as to the proof that you already made keeps, you know, is no longer holding. So, but on the other hand, this is the way the world works, right? I mean, poor Richard Jewell. How many of you remember Richard Jewell? You should remember him, because those of you who remember him only remember him as the guy who may have done the Olympic bombing in Atlanta. When, you know, FBI just eagerly went and caught somebody and said, this guy did it. Everybody remembered that because it was on the CNN headline news. And then like 18 months later, they realized he's not the guy. None of you guys remember it. And this guy recently passed away. And, you know, there were articles in the paper saying Richard Jewell, the guy who was not the Olympic bomber. Which is not exactly what your obituary should say about you, right? But, you know, the point was, based on the evidence, they decided this guy is doing it. And then based on more evidence, they decided that he's not. But that's the way we deal with world, okay? So monotonic logics are not good enough. You need to consider the truth change as extra knowledge comes in, which is essentially one aspect of uncertainty. There are other aspects. And to handle this, people have been trying various things, in particular, in general, in knowledge representation, and in particular in AI. Okay? What's interesting is the first things that they tried were always half-baked solutions. Okay? So for example, why don't we take propositional logic and throw in some hacks so that it would do something useful? Okay? For example, at the time when expert systems, you know, medical expert systems were all the rage, one of the things they did was they did this thing called certainty factors. They look like probabilities, but they are not just 1 and 0. They look like truth values, but they can be more than 1 and 0. But they are like probabilities in the sense they can be anywhere between 1 and 0, but they're not probabilities. Because if you actually try to figure out the semantics, it all falls apart on your face. There can be circular reasoning and all that fun stuff. Okay? And so many of these ideas, like satisfactions were tried, fuzzy logic has been tried and is still tried. And over a period of time, people realized that really the much better reasonable thing to do is either go from logic and talk about things called non-monotonic logic, which I might briefly mention, and or talk about just deal with probabilistic logics, which basically appeal to theory of probability directly. Okay? Now it turns out that once this has been shown to be working, some of these things fell by the wayside. So much so that people had to, but this did not completely fall by the wayside. Fuzzy logic is still being used, and there are, you know, conferences, etc., on this. There have been papers on this, for example, one by Charles Elkann called On the Paradoxical Success of Fuzzy Logic. And it couldn't mean good. Anytime somebody says on the paradoxical success of RAW, they probably are not saying good things about RAW, right? So this guy said on the paradoxical success of fuzzy logic, and he basically, despite these semantic problems that I pointed out, fuzzy logic is being used in many cases, and the argument in that paper is that in most of these cases, the inference is shallow. That means you basically use some facts to derive one more fact, but you don't use the derived fact along with other facts to derive more facts. Okay? If the inference is shallow, it turns out that some of the problems of fuzzy logic may not actually be seen. So in the applications where fuzzy logic is being used, the answer to you, you know, in the Japanese washing machines, which you have and I have, they say we are using fuzzy controllers. Essentially, they could as well have said we are using Bayesian controllers, because when the inference is shallow, there is not much of a difference. And when you can have deep inference, where you actually start chaining rules of inference, you can get into all sorts of problems in the context of fuzzy logic. Yes, sir?
Does it really need to be any deeper than shallow if you're just trying to figure out what new has happened
since last time? No, because what you may have, no. Actually, first of all, many common sense inferences may actually be shallow, but we also do deep inferences. Okay? The important point is, here is a logic, like probabilistic logic, which is fine for both shallow and deep inferences. And here is another logic called fuzzy logic, which seems to have troubles, but it seems to be okay for shallow inference. So why would I want to teach about this when I can just teach you this? That's essentially the way the world is right now. Okay? I'm not saying you should never do shallow inferences. I'm just saying for that special case, which may well be the big case, common sense reasoning oftentimes mostly is shallow reasoning. You know, fuzzy logic is fine, because its inbuilt problems don't show up their ugly head for those cases. So this is a paper called On the Paradoxical Success of Fuzzy Logic, and I'll try to send you a link to it. It was a 1990 paper. But that didn't make any difference. There's still like an entire community which talks about fuzzy logic and so on. Okay. This is my best understanding of the connections. Questions? Okay. Who thought this will take 30 minutes, but we never know. Okay. So then the rest is we are going to talk quickly about propositional logic that we already talked about last time. I'm more or less just going to show you the slides, remind you that in propositional logic there should be a syntax. Any logic needs a syntax. You know, so propositional logic has a syntax. It has proposition symbols, and there are connectives. This is a unary connective, negation. There are conjunction, disjunction. Now, these are really the only important connectives. There is an implication constraint, implication connective, but that actually is just a syntactic sugar. P implies Q is nothing but not P or Q. And of course, S1 if and only if S2 is yet another syntactic sugar, because that's nothing but conjunction of two implications which themselves are two disjunctions. Okay, but it's worth knowing those kinds of things. Now, the most important thing is for propositional logic is truth functional. Given a world is given by telling you whether certain for each proposition whether it's true or false in that world. Okay? Given a world, you can in that world tell for any statement that you can make in the propositional logic, you can tell whether it is true or false. It will be one of them. It won't be anywhere in between. It has to be either true or false. Okay? in a single word, propositional logic, that was the whole point that we were talking about. In a single word, the puppy is either red or white, no in between. Okay? That's the, and it is truth functional because the truth value of a compound sentence is described in the truth values of its composite, its constituent sentences. The truth value of A and B is described in terms of the truth table for if A is true, B is true, then A and B is true. If A is true, B is false, A and B is false, and so on and so forth. So you can apply that to figure out the truth value of each of the statements. Now, the only question, of course, is, as I said, if you are putting a statement, in a propositional statement into your knowledge base, if your knowledge base is completely empty, and you know that you're in a world where there are propositions P1 to P100, and your knowledge base is currently completely empty, then you know that you could be in any of the 2^100 possible worlds. And the moment I come and tell you a statement, P1 and P2 implies not P3 or not P7. Such a statement. The moment I said this, there is a certain loss of innocence. You no longer are free to believe that you are in any of the 2^100 worlds. You are now stuck with a subset of the 2^100 worlds. Again, was something I said last time, knowledge is not freedom, actually, if you think of freedom in terms of being, you know, in any possible world. The more knowledge you have, the more constrained the world that you are living in. You know, if you know science, you don't get to say, oh my God, God made everything happen. You know, at least if you care about consistency. Okay? So, as the extra knowledge statements are being added, as we talked about, the set of worlds consistent with the knowledge base is essentially intersection of the set of worlds that are consistent with each of the statements. And any time this set of worlds becomes empty, that means there is an inconsistency in the knowledge base. Okay? Now, again, these are the, now the, in terms of inference, the question, of course, is, if I want to answer whether a particular statement alpha is true, does a knowledge base entail alpha? Again, we talked about this, I'm just going through it again. The way we'll do it is we'll find out all the worlds where knowledge base is true. Okay? And make sure that in each of the worlds where knowledge base is true, alpha is also true. So the world for the alpha is a bigger circle. And the world of the knowledge base is a smaller circle, a W of K. Okay? It better be the case that every world consistent with your knowledge base is, I mean, every world that consistent with your knowledge base, alpha is true. Because of which, if you believe this, you must believe this. There is no other way. That's what entailment is. The moment you came to entailment, you're talking about sets of worlds. Because it's sets of worlds, I can have all sorts of interesting scenarios. So I can have, here is the set of worlds consistent with knowledge base KB. Here is the set of worlds consistent with alpha. Okay, this is alpha 1. Here is another set of worlds that's consistent with alpha 2, which is okay, and here is alpha 3. Which of these are entailed, which are not entailed? What? This is entailed. How about this? Because there are worlds where knowledge base is true, where alpha is not true. That's all that matters. It's not because this much of alpha is sticking out. It is because it's not taking everything. So for example, in particular, as long as the alpha is a superset of KB, it's fine. The world consistent with alpha, a superset of the world consistent with KB, that's fine. It's still entailed. Okay. Now, obviously, you can see here that you only care about whether it's entailed or not entailed. Okay. In particular, you don't make much of a distinction between these two cases. Here is KB, I'm sorry, I keep changing. Here is the world consistent with KB. Okay? Here is alpha 1. the world can stand up for. Okay, there's a little thing which where it's cutting. And here is alpha 2. As far as propositional logic is concerned, both alpha 1 and alpha 2 have the same entailment status. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you could be in one of 10 million worlds, and there are two statements, statement 1, which is true in every one of those 10 million worlds except one. Statement 2, it's basically not true in any of the worlds that you are in. Or it's only true in one of the 10 million worlds you are in. It turns out you don't differentiate between them, because it's either entailed or not entailed. When you go to the probabilistic logic, you differentiate between them. You say one is more likely than the other. Okay? Now, actually, I did make a mistake. If this were to be the case for W of alpha 2, and if you think of the entire world as this big square, then W of not alpha 2 is essentially everything outside of this circle, right? Which is a superset of W of KB, which actually means, in fact, alpha 2 is happier than alpha 1. Alpha 2, at least negation of it is entailed. Alpha 1, neither its negation is entailed nor it is entailed. Okay, the one that I was actually talking about earlier, the picture that I was trying to paint, is more like this. Where alpha 3 is only true in a small subset of worlds where the world is, the knowledge base is true, right? Again, in this case, alpha 3 and alpha 1 have the same entailment status. Negation of alpha 2 is actually entailed. Okay? Now, it turns out that once you have truth tables, you can actually deal with this sort of enumeration easily, this world easily, because if you have n propositional variables, you have 2 power n rows in the truth table. For small number of propositions, such as 3, we can write these truth tables. Okay? Others, you obviously can't, but you can think of them. So, the question here is, if alpha is ARB and knowledge base is ARC and B are not C, I want to check whether alpha is entailed. How do I do it? I will first of all, you know, make a truth table A, B, C for each possible world here. I will compute the truth values of all of the columns here. This is ARC, this is BR not C, and this is a knowledge base which is just a conjunction of both. And then alpha itself, remember alpha is ARB, so it has its own truth value. If you know the world, you know the truth value in the world. Okay, so you now actually, by computing this, I have computed the circle. The only question I need to check is whether the knowledge base circle is a subset, a proper subset, a subset of the alpha circle, the set of words. Okay,
so it is entailed in this case?
You have to check. Yeah, yes, in this case, I believe so. So alpha is true in these worlds, right? Alpha is true in these worlds. The knowledge base is true in all these worlds. This. Those are the only worlds where knowledge base is true. In each of those cases, alpha is true. That's all you care. Alpha is also true here, but I don't mind that. I don't begrudge alpha being true when knowledge base is not true. But I do care that when the knowledge base is true, the alpha is true. So in this case, it's entailed. I just did this picture basically in terms of rows. Now, if you do not like to actually look at each of the rows and see which are the ones for KB and then check whether in each of those rows alpha is also true, you could do the following thing. Take KB and negation of alpha. Make another column called KB and negation of alpha. That better be false all the time. Okay? So if this is false everywhere, then alpha must have been entailed. This is nothing but proof by refutation. Alpha must be true, because if alpha were to be false, the knowledge base and negation of alpha would be inconsistent. That means there is no world where alpha is not. That's what. Now, one interesting thing, of course, in all this is, what if the original knowledge base is inconsistent? That means it doesn't. In fact, there is no row where knowledge base is true. then we win. If your knowledge base is not true ever, then vacuously the alpha is true in every row where knowledge base is true. Okay, so this is the way logical inference works. Basically, you say if in fact the knowledge base is inconsistent, anything can be derived. Everything is entailed if the knowledge base is inconsistent, and that just goes from the way we define model theoretic semantics. Now, of course, in real world reasoning, what happens is this is the usual thing. In fact, you know, in various popular depictions of logic in movies and so on, they will try to induce an inconsistency in these computers' reasoning, and then it blinks all the red lights and dies, and then, you know, the good guys win, the bad guys lose, you know. But the basic point is that if there is inconsistency, then essentially everything is entailed. But in real world, you may have 10 million statements, and I tell you one statement that is inconsistent with what you believed in before, like such as maybe there is no God, and then you should not just blow up, right? And what you wind up doing in general is you try to figure out where is the inconsistency coming from, which is the smallest part of my knowledge base which is actually causing the inconsistency. And then start saying, let me try to disbelieve one of the things that are allowing me to prove inconsistency. That's how we get by. Okay? So in fact, if in fact knowledge base is inconsistent, theory revision is an idea where as you get new knowledge, if it is inconsistent with the old knowledge, then you have to blame something, either the stuff that you learned before or the stuff that you learned now. And, you know, you basically take a chance and say, anything that is taking part in the proof of inconsistency, which is an entailment of false, is fair game. And if you remove it for every proof, then you would have a consistent knowledge base again. Yes, sir? If in logic, if you do not remove the inconsistency, basically there is no semantics for what is entailed versus what's not entailed. You have to go out of this to non-monotonic logics, which essentially talk about interesting ideas of, you know, minimal consistency, minimal number of models, and so on. But I won't get into that. Yes, sir.
I understand the definition of entailment, but what's the significance of whether or not something is entailed or not entailed?
That's the cornerstone of our reasoning. I know some things about you. Based on that, I want to know, do I think you're going to pass, for example? Okay, I don't mean to sound intimidating. But the question is, no, I can wait until you take the exam and see whether you pass or fail, or I can just try to reason based on what I have, whether I can prove that you would pass. Okay, every knowledge-based agent ultimately should, rather than, I mean, the difference between a knowledge-based versus a non-knowledge-based agent is non-knowledge-based agent is always surprised. It's every day, it's a surprise the sun came up, you know, surprise I have to go to school, everything is surprise, you know. Whereas a knowledge-based agent is only surprised if what it believes was going to happen tomorrow didn't happen. And you want to reduce the amount of surprise, really. I mean, it's a weird way of thinking about it, but a perpetually surprised agent doesn't do anything much more than being surprised. Right? Oh, I'm surprised. I mean, it's good life, but you can't actually plan if you're completely surprised all the time. Okay? So entailment is the cornerstone. You are talking about, given what I know about the world and what I know about what my actions do to the world, can I tell myself what must be the next action to take? And if I can use this, if entailment shows that the next action must be A3, you just do A3. And then if A3 leads to kaboom and you all die, I mean, you didn't die hopefully, then you would say, must have been something wrong. Okay, and you have to figure out what went wrong. It cannot be the inference that went wrong, it has to be the knowledge that you have. Okay? Okay, let me go through this. I'll come back later, in fact. It's a great thing, but I would come back later. Okay, inference rules, we talked about it. Modus ponens, modus tollens. Abduction, A implies B. Modus ponens, modus tollens, chaining, A implies B, B implies C, allows you to entail A implies C. Okay, this is actually wrong. This is not called abduction. A implies B, does that imply that if I know that A implies B and then I know not A, do I know not B is true? So modus tollens is sound, but this is actually an unsound inference. But we want to use it. It's a plausible inference. It's unsound, but it's plausible. Okay? So, flu causes runny nose. Okay? Flu causes runny nose. So, if you don't have runny nose, if I know that flu does cause runny nose, if you don't have runny nose, I know that you don't have flu. That's modus tollens. If on the other hand I figured out you don't have flu and I don't feel like opening my eyes to check whether you have runny nose or not, I can't just assume with 100% certainty that you won't have runny nose, because runny nose could be caused by allergies, which has nothing to do with flu. But it's useful, because the moment I tell you this guy doesn't have flu, your belief that this guy won't have runny nose increases. It's not still 1.0, but it increases. So abduction is an inference rule which is not sound, but it is actually a useful rule. It winds up being used in the probabilistic reasoning. Okay. Now, the one that you could not do is this kind of one, which required resolution. You know, W implies J, and not W implies J, is J true? Okay. And modus ponens can't derive it, modus tollens can't derive it, but resolution can. Okay. Resolution rule goes like this. Again, we talked about it. If alpha are B and not beta or gamma, then you can derive alpha or gamma. That's resolution rule. And you can use resolution rule in the forward direction, where you keep applying all the resolution steps and see if what you want to entail has been derived. Or you can do in the negative direction, in backward direction, where you take what you want to prove, negate it, add to the knowledge base, and see if you can derive an empty class. Okay, both of which are valid ways of proving a theorem. Okay, in this particular case, resolution essentially, if you do forward, then you get JRJ. Now, if you use an extra rule saying JRJ is nothing but J, then you're done. Okay, which is a simplification. Whereas if you do backward, you add this, and also negation of what you want to prove, which is not J. And then if you do inferences, you can get an empty class. So those are two different methods of proving it. This one requires you to use a logical simplification. Here you just didn't use anything else other than resolution rule. Okay? Normal forms, the question of course is, I'm assuming everything is in this clausal form, which is a literal disjoined with another literal. A clause is a disjunction of literals. A literal is either a proposition or a negation of a proposition. And the form that we are looking at is clausal conjunctive normal form, where essentially you have a conjunction of clauses where each clause is a disjunction of literals. That's what we are assuming. The question, of course, is if I don't have things already in that form, can I bring them into that form? Turns out that conjunctive normal form is a canonical form, just as disjunctive normal form also is. Okay. If for those of you from CSE 120, digital design, you know that conjunctive normal form is nothing but a product of sums form, okay? And disjunctive normal form is nothing but sum of products form. So there is, the world is connected. They just have different names for this, okay? And you know that you can convert anything into product of sums or sum of products. There are also other forms which, these are canonical in the sense everything can be converted to either this or this, and I'm most interested in converting it to CNF. Okay. There's also this form called Hahn form, which is actually restricted. Not everything can be converted into Hahn form, but we'll talk about that later. But we don't need that as far as our use of resolution is concerned. For the use of resolution, any clause, I can do the following steps and I'll get it into the clausal form. Okay. What are the steps? Remove the implication. You remove the implication by converting A implies B into not A or B. Then pull the negation in. If the negation is over anything other than a proposition, you pull it inside. If it's a not of A or B, it becomes not A and not B. And if it's not A, not of A or B, then it becomes not A and not B. So either way, you pull the negation in. Okay? Once you put the negation in, then you can use De Morgan's law to distribute the disjunctions over conjunctions. Okay, all I'm saying there is if I have A and B or C, I can write this as ARC and AR and BRC. Once I do that, this is class 1, this is class 2, and I can ignore this and just put a comma. They'll become two different classes. So there is a procedure whereby you can convert everything into the classal form. That's all I want to say. Okay? Now, if you do have it, and this is the last thing I'll do today, it's a more longer example of using resolution inference, which is consider the following problem, which is if the grass is wet, then it is either raining or the sprinkler is on. If it's raining, then Timmy is happy. If the sprinkler is on, then Timmy is happy. If Timmy is happy, then he sings. Timmy is not singing. Okay. Now we want to prove that grass is not wet. That's what I want to prove. English. I'm assuming first you can prove this, you know, using your plausible reasoning. So I can convert this into a propositional logic theorem proving exercise where GW is a proposition standing for grass is wet, R means raining, SP means sprinklers are on, and TH means Timmy is happy, SG means Timmy is singing. Okay? So this statement becomes GW implies R or SP, this becomes R implies TH, this becomes SP implies TH, TH implies SG, Timmy is not singing, so not SG, and I want to prove not GW. Okay? Convert everything into classal form, I get these classes. Okay? Now, why did I add GW here? Because I want to do resolution refutation. To prove that grass is not wet, I add grass is wet to the database. Now I need to combine pairs of classes here and combine those inferred classes with other pairs, other classes until I get an empty class. So here is a way I can do it. Do this, I get R or SP. Do that and that, I get TH or SP. Do that and that, I get SG or SP. Do this and this, I get SP. Do this and this, I get TH. And do TH and not TH or SG, I get SG. Do SG or not SG, I get empty class. Obvious, right? This leads me to the last joke of the class before you go home, which is some years back, I believe, UK papers or BBC had a competition for the world's funniest joke. And these English are very funny about this. So they wanted to have the world's funniest joke, and people submitted jokes and other people voted on it. And how many of you know the world's funniest joke from that time? Which I'll tell you now, and then you get to go home. The world's funniest joke goes like this. So Sherlock Holmes and Watson went on a camping trip. And so they went around, they did the whatever thing, and then in the evening they pitched a tent and they went to sleep. Middle of the night, Sherlock Holmes wakes up and nudges Watson and says, Watson, look up and tell me what you see and what you can derive, what you can deduce from what you see. So what Watson says, I look up, there are stars, and it's a big sky, beautiful stars, this, that. This means A, it's not raining, and B, that we are not alone in this universe, there are stars. Stars means there may be intelligent forms in the other world, which means we can't have too much hubris, all that stuff, and it's going on. And then Sherlock Holmes says, Watson, you idiot, this means somebody stole our tent. Okay. Why is this interesting from our point of view? The problem is, when you have a huge number of sentences in your knowledge base, there is a mad chase for showing an empty class, which is inferences. Lots and lots of things can be inferred. The question is, what are the inferences that are relevant to something that you either want to prove, or more importantly, relevant to deciding what you're going to do next? You wake up in the morning and say, all the inferences you get to do, you would not actually come to the class, which is obviously the most important thing you need to do, right? And inference essentially involves search. Knowing how to do sound inferences is only part of the problem. The rest is, which inferences are you going to do? so that you can prove the theorem. And if you look at this, you know, as you saw me, and this is an exam question, you know, and you can imagine, you know, wincing. My God, am I going to do this? You know, a huge number of these inferences until I get an empty class. And believe me, there is something else I wanted to show you. There are mad chase for the empty class. One of the beautiful things that happens in the AI midterm is people would materialize in empty classes out of thin air. Because you need an empty class, right? If you can show the empty class, you know, Rao probably didn't ask me to prove a theorem that can't be attained. So I need an empty class. Find some way of making an empty class. And one classic way of making an empty class is this. PRQ, not P or not Q, term empty class. I have seen so many of us, including myself, who did this. This is not what resolution says, right? In fact, resolution does not allow you to resolve away two literals at the same time. Okay? You have to take, if you were to resolve this and this, then what would you get? You get Q or not Q. That's all. Or you can resolve this and this, you get P or not P. Neither of which are empty clauses. Empty class actually means there's an inconsistency. There is no inconsistency in believing this and this. Think of yourself. P, either P or Q should be true, and either P or Q should be false. That's not hard to do, right? And yet you find, you know, you'll find a way of doing empty class because you're essentially doing search in real time. So which brings us to the point that we'll talk about in the beginning of next class, which is how do we do search as part of inference, which should put you in cycles because last class we talked about how to do inference as part of search. So it's a total yin and yang. You need search to do inference, you need inference to do search. Okay? And if I can confuse you with that next class, then we will continue into probabilistic logic.